Leading in the Light of Eternity. And in the background here, you can see a famous clock. Does anyone know where that clock is? Prague. All right. One of the old astronomical clocks. It's interesting to look at the clock, but I don't know if you can see what's beside it because there's two figures to the left and two figures to the right. The two figures to the left symbolize vanity and greed, and the two figures to the right symbolize death and pleasure. And it's like, hey, get this in context. Time's passing, and you have three things that can pull you off the track, vanity and greed and pleasure, but count on the fact that you're going to die. You know, that this is, the time is really important. And it's interesting to put the passage of time in a bigger context of like the fact that we're going to die. But you were created for eternity. So death is not the end, which is really important. And we're going to look at a number of passages today. So if you've got your Bibles and can go with me and move. And then this is Ecclesiastes 3:11. 3:11, he has made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he's put eternity in a man's heart. So we actually were created with eternity in our hearts. Yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. So we all have eternity in our hearts, and we have this sense that, like, why am I getting older? There's something wrong with that. I should live a lot. Why is life so short? Why do people die? Death, it always is something wrong about it. And Christians, we know that, but non-Christians do too. That's why they try to think, how can I do something that lasts after I die? How can I prolong my life as long as possible? Somehow we sense that the fact that life ends, there's something not right about that, that we were created for eternity. And in 1 Corinthians 15:19, Paul talks about the resurrection. He says we're all going to be raised. And he says, by the way, if we weren't raised, we would be of all men most to be pitied. He said our work would be in vain. Our preaching would be in vain. In other words, if there was no eternity, if there was no resurrection, you can just cancel the value of everything we're doing. It actually gains value only when it's put in the context of eternity. He says, if Christ we have hope in this life only, we are of all people most to be pitied. Which means that we really need to look at everything we're doing in this context of eternity. If we take it out of the context of eternity, it actually will lose its meaning. Context is really important. And its chief aim is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. There's this forever aspect to what we're doing that if we pull that out, then everything else we have loses its meaning. In fact, information only has meaning in context. Have you heard that phrase? It's information, but only has meaning in context. And we need to know, how do we place our leadership in the context, say, of eternity? So you do something right now so you can see it. Take your finger, close one eye. You need to do this with me. Okay, I'm in youth ministry, so you got to be involved. Close one eye, pull the other one all the way up to your eye, and describe your finger. Is it a little blurry? Like when it's too close, it's actually hard to understand, and it's obscuring everything else. Now pull it back and put it in context, and now you see it clearly, but you also see how it fits into everything else. You see it's tied into your arm and all that. So all of our leadership challenges, we often are pulling different leadership challenges close to our eyes to understand them. Sometimes we have to pull them away and place them in the bigger context so that whatever challenge you're facing of planning a retreat for next weekend or recruiting staff or fundraising gets placed into the context of eternity, because actually that's when we're going to see it most clearly. If it doesn't have context, it will become formless and kind of a mess. So let me give you just an example of that. We all are invited to go on a wonderful voyage with an amazing ship that's going on its maiden voyage. It's called the Titanic. I don't know if you've ever heard about it, but it's just an amazing boat. There's been no ship made like it in history. It's to the most modern specifications. It's one of the fastest steamers that exists. Not only that, there's been no expense saved in the equipping of this ship with the best dining facility and the nicest rooms and all those things. And you get invited on this maiden voyage. It's the first voyage. really interesting people on it, wonderful experience. So we all get on, and you start, what are you going to do? Well, there's interesting people. How can I meet as many of them as possible? Maybe some of those rich and famous. Maybe I'll meet some of them. I want to explore the ship, especially that dining room that's supposed to be amazing and that staircase that is all wood and wow, that's just going to be great. I probably should be wearing nice clothes so that I impress the other important people that are on this ship. There's a lot of good food. I want to make sure I really enjoy it. And then journeys like this are fun because you don't have to do anything. So I brought some books along and I'm going to read a couple murder mysteries and a novel. And I want to read a couple good books. Okay, so that's what I'm doing with the information that's in front of me. Now, I've heard that this is the first voyage, but I'm thinking this is the first voyage, I'm just projecting, of 5,000. But what if I do this and go, this is the first voyage of 0.5 voyages? Like, this is the first voyage. Is this the first voyage of 5,000, or is this the first voyage of 0.5? Exactly the same information, I put it into a different context. All the same. Now what are you going to do on the boat? You're on the first voyage of 0.5. Yeah, I want to meet some people. I want to meet someone who knows how to row. Because I need to be friends with someone who knows how to row. And I'm going to explore the ship, but I don't care about that circular staircase and that dining room. I want to find out where the lifeboats are. And where's the entrance to it, and practice it. I'm going to be thinking about how to dress, not to impress, but to stay warm. So I don't care what you think about my clothes. I'm putting all of them on, and I'm going to walk around because it's going to get cold here. When I go into the dining room, I'm not thinking about those wonderful desserts. I'm thinking about what food is compact that I can stick in my pocket because I've got to have some food for a while. And not in this dining room. And I am reading, but I'm reading survival books. How do you survive in the cold? Do you see how that information, if it's placed in a different context, is this ship, and it's all the same information about the ship, is this ship sailing for 5,000 voyages or is it sailing for 0.5? And so this changes how we approach all of life. Every single bit of information around us has meaning it has totally different meaning when I place it in a totally different context. Now, actually, that illustration is partially correct. You know, we've got death coming at us, but actually death is not the end, right? So now let's put it in a bigger context. Oh, by the way, you're going to get in a lifeboat. It's going to be really cold. You're going to fall asleep, and then you're going to wake up and find you've been rescued. You've been rescued. And you'll end up on this island that no one knew exists. In fact, it's not an island, it's a continent. It's not that, it's just a whole world. And you'll find that the people who rescued you, they're royalty and they've adopted you into their family. And then you find that on this special place that's much larger than you possibly could imagine, no one dies. And that's actually where you're going to end up after you fall asleep in the lifeboat. Okay, now back up the story. And you're on the Titanic 0.5 of 1. Now it's really fascinating because I've got to think about how to use my time between now and when the ship sinks, but I'm actually using it in light of the continuing story that ends up afterwards. So I've got two things. I've got something that looks long that's actually really short and something that looks short that's actually really long. And I've got to make my decisions in the light of both of those realities. So that changes everything. Just changes everything you do on the Titanic, everything. So I might not just be reading books on survival, but I might want to start learning the language if I could find a book on the language of the people that I'm going to be going to. And I'm going to be thinking, is there anything that I could take that would work, that would still be good on that island that I could take with me? Like, what could I take if the lifeboat actually will get rescued? I wonder what I'd want on that island from the ship. Some things I wouldn't, some things I wouldn't. You see how it just changes? It changes everything you do, everything you do. Do have any of you, I'm sure you have, you've read the Narnia series? It's so amazing. Wow, you get into it, it's so rich and interesting and metaphorical and emotional. And when I was a kid, I read the books and then I put off reading the last one, The Last Battle, as long as I could. Because if you've got a good series and you know that there's a last book, you know, once you've read that last book, you're done with the series and there's nothing more to read. I just kind of ration them out. And so finally, okay, I've got to read The Last Battle because it's the last one, and then I'll be done with Narnia. So I started reading it, and it's a dark book. It's darker than what you expect. They land, there's this jolt on a train, and then they land back in Narnia, and they find it's just this horrible mess. It's disintegrating. It's falling apart. And there's this battle, and they enter into the battle. But before they entered in and things got better, and here they enter in and things just get worse. And the evil is bigger and darker, and the enemy is fiercer, and the situation is more complicated. And you just find the story is just getting worse and worse and worse. And you're following and going, wait, is this isn't Narnia. This isn't the right story. Where's Aslan? How come Aslan's not going to show up? What's going on? And then it gets to the end. It gets so dark that it seems this evil force is taking over, and the rescuers, these children who are kings and queens but are back there and aren't doing good at ruling, get thrown into this tent to be eaten by this evil creature. And the minute they go through the door, they're in a meadow with sunshine, and the birds are singing. And they look back, and it's actually a door. They look through the door, and there's this horrible evil place that's falling apart, and they've been somehow catapulted, and Aslan, who they thought had left him, is standing right there with them. And they walk around. You remember this? They walk around the doorway, and they, what's going on? This is crazy. And they find that Aslan actually doesn't fix Narnia. He takes them out of Narnia, but he takes them into some place that looks like Narnia. It's like a reflection. But wait, no, the other Narnia was a reflection of this Narnia. Like, this is the real Narnia, and that was the shadow Narnia, and this is the real. All of a sudden, everything's starting to just spin in their minds. And Aslan takes them, and they start running, and the battle's just far behind. He didn't fix the battle. He actually just took them out of it, and it kind of disintegrated, and they're in this new reality. And they go through Narnia, and it's getting realer and better, and they realize that this actually, this looks like the real Narnia. And then at some point, so this is going to be hard for me to read because I still feel really emotional about this spot. At some point they say, Aslan, when are we going back? Back to London. No? Because that's always what happens. And he says, you're not going back. You know, that thing on the train, it wasn't just magic. It was a real crash. And you've died. And then he says, the term is over. Term is over. The holidays have begun. The dream is ended. This is morning. Wow. Like, the dream is ended. This is morning. And as he spoke, he no longer looked to them like an island, like a lion. But the things that began to happen after that were so great and beautiful that I cannot write them. And for us, this is the end of of all the stories. And we can most truly say that they lived happily ever after. But for them was only the beginning of the real story. And their life in this world and all their adventures in Narnia had only been the cover and the title page. Now at last they were beginning chapter one of the great story, which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever, which every chapter is better than the one before. Sorry about this. I actually can never read this without breaking down. Because that's true. And there's going to come a tragic spot in your life and my life where things get really dark and the train stops and we get ejected out of this world, and we're going to land in the reality, this really reality, in the place where we're meant to be. And we're going to find that was a shadow. This is a shadow and that's real. And this is the cover page and that's the real story, and it's going to go on forever. And we're going to find that. And then he goes on, he says, in The Problem of Pain, C.S. Lewis says, you've never had it. All the things that have ever deeply possessed your soul have been just hints of it, tantalizing glimpses, promises never quite fulfilled, echoes that died away just as they caught your ear. But if it should really become manifest, if there ever became an echo that did not die away but swelled into the sound itself, you would know it, beyond all possibility of doubt, you would say, here at last is the thing I was made for. He's saying you're just getting glimpses, you're getting tastes, and you taste them, and they're good, but you sense that there's something more. And he says there's going to be a time where the echo turns into music, where the shadow becomes reality, and you're going to go, oh, this is what I was made for. So, brothers and sisters, that's what's ahead. You know, that's what's ahead. That's the big story. That's the big story that our small story is a part of. And actually, that changes everything. That changes everything. When I put anything into the context of eternity, that your context is eternity. And so just like the kids in the last battle, they have this understanding of what's going on, and then all of a sudden everything spins and all the information is the same, but it's totally different. What they knew is true, but it's being placed in a bigger context of reality, and they realize it's only part of the story, and the context is eternity, and that context changes everything. Okay, I feel really emotional about that, and I hope you do too, because that's such a beautiful, amazing story, and we feel it in our hearts, because eternity is in our hearts, and so there's something in our hearts that says, yes, that's what I was made for, and it gives meaning and purpose to everything else. So, okay. So how, I got to breathe. So let's go back to some of the issues of leadership and just say, what happens if you do this to that? What happens if you take that thing that you're seeing up close and see it from a little farther away and see it in the context of eternity? How does that change? How does all the information about that Titanic change when I know it's 0.5 voyages that actually lead into something else that is really a lot better than the Titanic would ever be? So what about your calling in the light of eternity? What about your calling in the light of eternity? 1 Corinthians 9:19. For though I am free from all, I've made myself a servant of all, so that I might win more of them. So he's saying, I'm actually becoming a servant to everyone. And then if you go on to 24 and 27, it says this, do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I don't run aimlessly. I don't box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I should be disqualified. So you have this sense of his ministry, his calling goal is located outside of this world. His calling is anchored in eternity, and he's running for a prize that's on the other side of death, that's in that spot. And that actually aligns all of his activities, allows him to run with purpose and with focus, gives him the energy to discipline and stay on track, allows him to be a servant, because he sees the finish line in eternity. The finish line is not down here. So we can sometimes move the finish line into temporal space and out of eternal space. And the finish line can be, I've got to get this school that we started running. I need to get this ministry going. I've got to get all of our staff funded. So we pull our goal too close. And we're not running for that finish line. And it can actually change the way we spend our energy. We might get distracted with a lot of little things. We might get discouraged. We can lose our focus. So how do we move the finish line, your finish line, your ultimate goal, out of the temporal into the eternal? And that will actually change how you run. So your goal, you're running for a finish line. When you run into the arms of Jesus, and there's an eternal prize, and you want that prize, you don't want this prize. So this prize could be, you know, I get our church fixed, or I get our city turned around, or I get it, and that's the prize. No, that's not the prize. That's part of what's going to actually just all burn up. The prize is located on the other side of death in the arms of Jesus when I run across. And this really, in Philippians 3, he says, not that I've already obtained it, but this one thing I do, forgetting what is behind, pressing towards ahead, what's ahead, I press on to the goal which God has called me heavenward. So you just see him, he's just laser focused on the finish line that's in the eternal and not in the temporal. Or in 2 Timothy 4:7 and 8, he says, now I'm being poured out. I'm at the end of this race. But he says, I fought the good fight. I've kept the faith. I finished the race. And now there's in store for me a crown of life, which awaits all those who serve him. So he's just got that finish line located out there, and it changes his sense of calling. When I first moved to the Czech Republic, I taught English at a high school about an hour from here, a town called Habajov, and was just praying that God would allow me to share Christ with people in school. And one of those who I got to share Christ with, his name is Pavel, and he put his faith in Jesus. And then I began discipling him. He went off to university in Prague and got an economics degree, and then went on and got a master's in business. Was very good in school. And he got hired by GE in Prague, which for a young Czech guy, that's a big deal. You get part of a multinational company. And did well in GE. In fact, he was chosen to be part of a group of younger leaders that they flew all around the world to train them for future leadership in GE. So he'd get flown to the United States, and they'd spend a month in a company analyzing it. And he'd get flown to Dubai. And he just got flown up. So I'm sitting in the Czech Republic going, wow, you got a great job. You know, Dubai, this place, staying in the best hotels, eating all this. It was all expense accounts, everything. And then a little bit later, he came back and started working for a Czech aeronautical company that was associated with GE. Oh, yeah, what a successful career. And I remember one time we kept in touch. He came and visited me. We started talking. He says, I'm just really unsatisfied. And I said, why? He said, I'm not seeing the meaning in this. Not seeing the meaning in this. I said, well, Pavel, have you ever thought about joining our team? We could use your business experience. I did, you know? And I said, but listen, you're going to have to raise your own support. There's not going to be expense accounts for expensive hotels and great food. The career path doesn't look, your parents and probably everyone who knows you is going to say, what in the world did you do leaving this unbelievable job? And I said, but I'm inviting you. And several months later, he came back and he says, I accept, which was just kind of blew me away. And I asked him, I said, Pavel, what? Look at what you're leaving. Look at what you're coming to. Why did you accept that? And he says, well, I wanted to trade the small story for the big story. He said, I want to trade the small life for the big life. The unimportant activity for that which is truly important. Now, you see how that's flipped? You could, from a worldly standpoint, say, you got it made in the shade. This career is amazing. But as soon as he puts his finish line on the other side of death, everything looks different. Because he goes, so much of what I'm spending my life on is just going to go like this. It's just going to disappear. So if my finish line is on the other side of death, then I want to get into the big story. I want to get into the things that matter, so that when I cross that finish line, I get the right reward, because I could get rewards in GE, and they're just gonna deck chairs on the Titanic, because the Titanic's going down. And so he's one of my closest coworkers right now. He's using his business experience to help us reach young people across the region. And he says, I'm so happy that I'm spending my life on what matters. So you see how that moving that finish line changes the significance of what you're doing and the things that really make a matter. I remember when I was in college and actually I was in high school getting ready to go to college, and I met with a counselor and we talked about my different college options, and I said, I want to go study at a Bible school. And she said, are you serious? She said, you've got really good grades. You've got an excellent resume here. I could get you into any university, any program you want. I said, yeah, this is the one I want. And she said, and then she started saying, you know that you're not going to make a lot of money doing this. You know this, and you know this. He said, and then finally at the end, she said, well, if you want to throw away your life, yeah, you can. And I said, that's exactly it. I don't want to throw away my life. That's why I'm doing this. I don't want to throw away my life. So you move the finish line into eternity, and everything looks different. The things that have value look different. The things that are worthless look totally different. And I said, thank you. I don't want to throw away my life. So I'm going to spend it on things that last forever. Jim Elliot said, he was a missionary to South America, died as a martyr. He says, Father, make of me a crisis man. Bring those I contact to decision. Let me not be a milepost on a single road. Make me a fork that men must turn one way or the other upon a encountering, facing Christ in me. And then he also said, singleness, simplicity is required of me. One treasure, one single eye, and one soul master. And so you just have, it's that, that's kind of what we hear from Paul. Like, I'm pressing towards the goal. I got one, I got a prize I'm going after. I'm going to buffet my body. I'm going to be a servant. I'm going to make my decisions in the light of this finish line that's across on the other side of death. Okay, here's another one. Your devotional life in the light of eternity. And this is in, we can go here and look at Colossians 3. Here he says, if then you've been raised with Christ, but he actually, it's better to say, since then you've been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things that are on earth, for you've died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with him in glory. Then he goes, put to death, therefore, whatever is earthly in you. You know, it's interesting that when he gets to the changes that need to take place in us, he anchors them in eternity. He says, start out by looking at where you are in heaven and thinking about who God made you to be, and then step down and put off these behaviors that because they aren't fitting. Don't lie, do those kinds of things. And then he says in verse 12, put on as God's chosen ones. So here's one of the things. Whenever we go to learn and grow and read Scripture, it's important that even we're anchoring that in eternity. So I was talking with someone recently, and they were talking about some issues that they were facing, and I said, well, first of all, think about who you are in Christ, but also recognize that these things are going to get taken care of. So if you're wondering if you're going to be successful at this, you will, because what's going to happen is at some point you're going to die and God's going to finish his sanctifying work and you're going to be perfect. So relax. So let's go at this instead of just this is who I am in Christ, and now I better put off those things that don't fit that. But I put them off in the light of eternity. It's God's going to finish his work. So if you're wondering if you're going to fail, you may, but he's not. He's going to get you to where he wants you to be. And so even as we approach Scripture and as we approach change that needs to happen in us, we need to anchor it in eternity and in a confidence in what our destination is. Now here's another one, your priorities in the light of eternity. Your priorities in the light of eternity. I told you I grew up in Denver. And when my dad was 94, I was visiting him in Denver. And we had this conversation, and he said, you know, Dave, I'm going to probably die here pretty soon. I said, yeah, no, Dad, you're doing fine. He said, no, you've got to face this. I'm not going to be around here forever. I said, yeah. He said, so I want to talk to you about my funeral. Okay, went through. And in this conversation about his funeral, I mentioned that I'd only been to two funerals in my life. I work with young people, so I spent a lot of time with young people, and then they don't die as often as old people do. And so I'd only been to two funerals. And he looked at me and said, you're kidding. And I said, no, I'm not. And he says, I'm going into a funeral tomorrow. You're coming with me. Dad, I've only got 2 days with you, and you want to spend half of one of those days at a funeral together? This doesn't sound like much fun. I flew all the way to Denver to spend time with my dad, and he's going to take me to a funeral. You take me to a movie or hiking or something like that. Don't take me to a funeral. And then he went to Ecclesiastes, and he said, you know that passage, it's better to visit a day of mourning than a house of feasting, for death is the end of every man, and the living should take that to heart. He said, you need to go with me to this funeral. So I was like, okay. I didn't even really know the people, and I dressed up, and we went there, and we sat there, and it was such a profound experience. Maybe been to more. A good funeral is a profound experience. It's like so perspective giving. This woman had lived her life in honor of Jesus. The eulogy was so inspiring. It was funny. It was sad. It was lifting up. And you sat there and you went, "Wow, I want to be like that." And you saw the things that remained and the things that weren't didn't. You know, like what she left behind. And it was connecting with, it was actually, I walked away going, That was a surprisingly rich experience at a funeral. It was better than a movie. I did not want to go. It was better than a movie. So that was in about October. Fast forward to July of the next year, July 12th. I was in Czech and was up late at night about 11:30 or 12, and I got a text from my brother, and he said, "Dave, I think you need to come to Denver." My brother was in Denver visiting my parents. I said, "Why?" He says, "I think Dad's going." And I said, "How much time do I have?" And he says, "You need to go right now." So it was 11:30. I got online, bought a ticket for 7 the next morning from Krakow at 11:30. Packed, drove through the night, got a COVID test at 4 a.m. at the Krakow airport because I couldn't travel without a COVID test. Got on a plane, and I flew to Denver. So I got the news at 11:30, and by 2 the next afternoon, I was landing in Denver. So that's how quick. What? Denver time. Not, yeah. So it had been a long time of traveling. And the whole way, I'm just thinking about this. I don't know. Is this the last time I'm going to see my dad? And I thought back to a conversation we had about a month and a half before that, where I said, "Dad, what is it like? You're in this stretch and we're all going to go through it. What's it like?" He says, "It's really strange." Someone asked him once, "Dick, how are you doing?" And he says, "I'm dying." And they said, "Wow, what's that like?" He says, "It's kind of strange. I've never done this before." So, yeah. So I said, "Yeah, what are you experiencing, Dad?" And he said, it's like climbing a high mountain in the fog. And you get higher and higher, and as you're getting higher, the air gets thinner and thinner, and it's steep. And you know at some point you're going to step off the top. You just don't know where it is, and so you just keep going. You know, but climbing a high mountain in the fog with it. So I'm thinking about this. I land at 2. I get to my parents' house, and my dad is already not responsive. So he's laying in a chair in our living room, and his eyes are closed, and he's breathing like this. It was just like he was climbing a mountain. Yeah. Just like it was in that last stretch. So we just gathered around him and just stood watch while he hiked that last stretch. And he wasn't in our with us, but it was like a holy moment, you know, as we're standing there as somebody finishes the race. He's finishing his race. And didn't know how long they'd be. You never know how long that's going to be. But about close to, my sister called me. I was downstairs. She says, "You got to come up." And I came up. And my dad was like this. And then all of a sudden, he opened his eyes, looked around, gulped, and just stopped breathing, closed his eyes and stopped breathing. It was just like he stepped off the top of the hill. And we were all there when that happened. And right at that moment, it was like 2 minutes before midnight, and my parents have clocks that are cuckoo clocks that their whole house is full of cuckoo clocks. And 1 minute later, all the cuckoo clocks start going. It was just like they're echoing the bells, you know. And my mom had laid down, and so my brother ran into the room to get her, and she's a little hard of hearing now, so she couldn't understand totally what he was saying. And she came out, and she saw him, and she stopped, and she said, "He's gone. Praise the Lord." That's an interesting response from someone who loses their spouse of so many years. Praise the Lord. And then we just kind of were in this. Well, the next couple of days were such a surreal experience because, and some of you have been through this, death just kind of puts everything in a different perspective. All of a sudden, there's things that you take for granted that are super precious. They're just so precious. And things that you think are really important that aren't important at all. Like whatever I canceled back home, I don't care about that. Dad's garden that he did, well, we're not going to plant it this year. It's gone. But then there's this legacy of things that last forever. And it's those moments all of a sudden we go, what do I care about? You know, here's some things about like 1 Corinthians 7 talks about marriage, and it says, hey, you can marry or not marry, but in the end, we're headed to heaven anyways. Ephesians 5 talks about marriage and family. But he puts it in the light of eternity, like we're getting ready for our marriage feast. In Hebrews 10:25, he says, encourage one another all the more as you see the day approaching. In other words, so our marriage, our singleness, our relationships should all be done in the light of eternity. In Hebrews 11:13, he says, these people were pressing ahead with faith because they saw some things from afar. And so actually our view of eternity, and I didn't get this on the, but it changes the way we relate to our family, changes the way we relate to our community, changes the way we relate to our children, changes the way you relate to your church if you're seeing things in the light of community. And so picture that kind of moment and then say, in that moment when I look forward into eternity, what are my priorities? And then how can I live those priorities all the time, not when I'm just at a funeral? Because those are actually true. Someone worked in an old folks' home in England for missionaries, and someone asked her, she said, are you ever there when they die? And she said, I wouldn't miss it. I wouldn't miss it. And they said, why? And she says, well, when a servant of God goes home, you always catch a glimpse of heaven as they go through the door. Yeah, catch a glimpse of heaven as they go through. And there's something like profoundly priority shaping about that. All of a sudden in that moment you go, oh, all of a sudden I really care about some things and I care less about some other things, because in the light of that moment and in that journey, stepping through and knowing that that's the, you know, I'm just thinking about those bells ringing in heaven for my dad. I mean, look forward to seeing him someday. And I'm thinking, in the light of that, how do I live? Because I'm headed towards that same top of the mountain, and I'm going to have to walk that stretch, and it's not going to be easy. I'm going to step into the arms of Jesus at some point. What's that going to be? What's it going to be like for me? When I was in my 30s, someone challenged me with an exercise he called the tombstone exercise. And he said, think ahead and figure out what you want written on your tombstone. So you're gone, and this is how people remember you. And then work backwards and live towards that goal. That's, you know, you're setting your goal way out there. So I did that. I did the tombstone exercise, and I wrote down that I would love to be known by three things. That here was a man who loved God. He was a man of God who loved God and loved people. That was what I wanted to know. He's a man of God who loved God and loved people. That would be cool. That would be written on my tombstone. And then I said, okay, how am I living? And I realized that I was living like this is a busy guy who's trying to get as much done as possible and build something down here on this earth. And I realized the way I was living was I was living towards different priorities. I actually wasn't living towards I want to be a man of God who loves God and loves people. I was living with a finish line that was much closer, and it really was a wonderful time to say, if I was living in the light of that, how would I change the way I'm approaching my everyday challenges here? The tombstone exercise. Your leadership identity in the light of eternity. Look at Philippians 1, 21 through 26. This is Paul. He's in prison, and he says, I look forward and I see two options. One of them is, in verse 20, he says, it's my eager expectation and hope that I will not be ashamed, but will have full courage as always. Christ will be exalted in my body. For me, to me to live is Christ, to die is gain. If I live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet what shall I choose? I cannot tell. I'm hard pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ Jesus because of my coming to you again. Okay, he's in prison, and he looks ahead and he says, I see two options. One is that I can live and suffer, or I can die and go and be with Jesus. Now, if you were looking at that, going, I'm looking forward and I see two options, prison or death, you would probably say, are those the only two options? Like, neither of those are any good. I'm choosing between two bad things. I don't like the choices. And he looks ahead and he goes, I have two incredible options. I can live in prison, and this will be fruitful labor to you. Or I can die and be with Jesus. I can't decide. There's so, these two things. I wish, wow, this one's good and this one's good. I think I'll stay here. Isn't that crazy that he's looking ahead to two options that we would say, I don't like either of them. And he says, I can't decide between them because they're both so good. And it's in the light of eternity because he recognizes that this jail is more than just jail. It's fruitful labor on behalf of people. And he recognizes that death is not just death. It's entrance into the presence of God. And that changes the way he leads. He's leading in the light of eternity. So it changes your longings, what you're longing for. It changes your destiny. It changes your service. My dad tells a story of when I was a small child. I don't remember this, but he tells a story that one night he just looked beside, he was going to bed and he looked beside me and I'm just standing next to him in the dark. I was about 8 years old. And he says, Dave, what are you doing? And I said, I'm scared. He said, why? And I said, I had a dream and in my dream I died and I'm just afraid of dying. So my dad said, well, Dave, have you put your faith in Jesus? I said, yeah. And he said, so where are you going to go? And I said, well, I'm going to heaven. You know what that's like? Yeah. He said, so you don't need to be afraid of death. And I said, well, yeah, I know I'm going to heaven, but I don't want to go now. I'm having too much fun down here. So he talked about that, you know, sometimes we think the only fun is down here. And then we get to heaven and it's clouds and harps and a lot of sitting around. It's not near as fun as this organization you're building and this publishing company you're leading and this church you're planning or this degree you're getting. But actually, Paul says, oh, wow, that looks like a lot of fun. Can't wait to get there. It's going to be amazing. And so how do we have your leadership identity in the light of that? There was about 10 years ago, I got to a stretch where I really burned out in ministry and I asked for a sabbatical. And the first 40 days, I was so tired. I have you ever been in that spot where I just couldn't think? And I couldn't do much. I wanted to read, but I'd start reading a leadership book and I'd get stressed. And I'd start reading a theology book and I'd get stressed and I'd start reading. So I decided to read a book on heaven. And because I had to fill my time, I don't know if you've ever seen the book by Randy Alcorn on heaven. It's this thick, that thick on heaven. For me, heaven is just clouds and harps, and I'm going to go there. That's fine. So I started reading this thick book on heaven, and it was just amazing. For like a week, I just read about heaven. And for about 2 weeks, I just thought about heaven. And what was so amazing is after spending a lot of time thinking about heaven, I returned to my work, and I felt totally different about my work down here because I had a clear view of where I headed, where I was headed. So this is your leadership identity. You can stay here and be some fruitful labor, or go on to Jesus, which is better by far. We profess to be strangers and pilgrims seeking after a country of our own, yet we settle down in the most unstranger-like fashion, exactly as if we were quite at home and meant to stay as long as we could. I don't wonder apostolic miracles have died. Apostolic living certainly has. Now again, this is not frantic living. This is sojourner living, stranger living. Living like we're passing through and we've got a destination in another place and we're seeking after a country that is in another spot. So it's not about getting all this world fixed as quickly as possible before we get ejected, but it's actually about sojourning through a world that's going to get destroyed. In the end, it's all going to get destroyed and we're going to get to another place. Your ministry in the light of eternity in 1 Corinthians 3, 10 through 15. He says, according to the grace of God given to me, like a skilled master builder, I laid a foundation, someone else is building on it. Let each one take care how he builds on it. For no one can lay a foundation other than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will become manifest, for the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed by fire, and fire will test the sort of work one has done. If that work of anyone who's built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, but he himself will be saved, yet only as through fire. So what I got to realize is that my work's my the thing I'm building is going to pass through the fire, and some is going to get burned up, and some is going to remain. So how can I be building with the right kinds of materials so that when the fire tests it, that it remains? And then in 1 Corinthians 15:58, he says this: "Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain." So that's the other thing, is I need to think about what will last, but I need to remember that it does last. That the things you're doing, if they're entrusted to God, have eternal significance. And that's pretty cool, knowing that your labor in the Lord is not in vain, and it labor that lasts into eternity, labor that's motivated by maturity in eternity, which that's just awesome. I have but one passion. This is Zinzendorf. It is he alone. So you notice his passion is not ministry, it's Jesus. That's what's really interesting. "The world is a field, and the field is a world, and henceforth that country shall be my home, where I can be most used in winning souls for Christ." Count Nicholas von Zinzendorf. Some people said that he was the most Christocentric leader of his century. He was so focused on Christ. But that caused him actually to be very mobile in his ministry, very sojourner-like, and focused on things that would last forever because of his love for Jesus. Your sufferings in the light of eternity. 2 Corinthians 4, 7-18. "But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God, not to us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not given to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so the life of Jesus may also be manifest in our bodies. So we who are alive are always being given over for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may be manifest in the mortal flesh." So sometimes we think, the goal is that I get everything together and that this pot looks really good. And that's actually not the goal. The goal is that Jesus shines through the cracks. Now I can have cracks and other things shine through them, like my frustration or my anger or my selfishness or my pride. But a pot with no cracks also is not going to be good. I want to be a cracked pot with Jesus shining through. And that's the goal. And actually, your ministry should be cracked pots with Jesus shining through. Sometimes we think it's, I'm going to build the perfect church. I'm going to build a perfect nonprofit or the perfect team. Well, actually, there would be no space for Jesus to shine through in all of your perfection. What we want is we want the thing inside to be shown, and it has to be shown. It's going to be shown through weakness. And so we need to be asking the question, how is Jesus shining through the holes of our organization? How is Jesus shining through the holes of our church? How is Jesus being manifest through the holes of my leadership? Because that's the point, is the exaltation of Jesus Christ. And that's where in 2 Corinthians he says, he wants them to take away this thorn in the flesh, and he says, hey, my power is made perfect in weakness. And he says, I'm going to boast about my weaknesses. And in Romans 8, he says, your suffering is not, we need to look at this one because this one's so great. Romans 8 is not worth comparing. Romans 8, 18, he says, "For I consider that the suffering of this present time is not worth comparing with the glory that's to be revealed in us." Well, that's like if we would compare it, if we'd go like this, suffering, suffering, suffering. Oh, it's terrible, it's suffering. Well, it's nothing to be compared with the glory that comes from that. And then he says in 28, which is what I was talking to my brother about this morning, and we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. And what's the purpose? For those he foreknew, he also predestined to become conformed to the image of his son in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. So the purpose is he's changing me, he's making me more like Jesus, and that's eternal. Like any change he does in me, it stays around forever. Remember one time I was we were in the thick of some real difficulties in our ministry in Czech, and I called my dad, who he's with Jesus now, but for all the years that he lived was maybe my best friend. you know, just right up top there, which is wonderful to have that kind of relationship with your dad. And so I called him, I said, Dad, and I described what was going on. So this is going on, this is going on, this is going on. Well, do you know how to fix that? No, I don't. Do you know how that's going to work out? I said, no, I don't. I said, from my standpoint, it looks really hopeless. I just don't know what to do next. And I said, I'm super discouraged. I'm depressed. I'm down. He said, I'm excited. And I said, what do you mean you're excited? I'm lost. And he says, yeah, I'm lost too, but I'm excited. And I said, what do you mean by that? He says, well, just think about if your life was a missionary biography and we were all reading it. And so when you get to those spots where everything starts to fall apart, that's where the story gets really interesting. Otherwise, it would be a boring story. It's like a movie where nothing goes wrong. You know, that's a boring movie. And if you're reading this book and it's been published and it's a missionary biography, you know that somehow it ends well. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been written. So he says, so if you're in the middle of this biography, you're going, I wonder how God's going to solve this one. Now it's getting really exciting. And that's where you lean forward and it gets exciting. And I said, well, Dad, I don't know how my story ends. He says, of course you know how your story ends. We all know how our stories end. We know how they end. So this is exciting. We're just going to see how God takes you through this. And that was a really interesting perspective for me. So I was like, okay, God, how are you going to take care of it? How are you going to show your character? How are you going to reveal yourself? How are you going to glorify? How are you going to lead us? And it's actually at the times we're the most lost that we have the most deep experience of the presence of God and the miracles. He leads the Israelites out of Egypt. Why does he lead them to a big ocean and put an army behind them? And then he says, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. So if you know the bigger story, if you can kind of step back from the book and go, I know how it ends, and I know the kind of book that's being written, and those books are written in this kind of way, well, then we go, this is a really exciting stretch. I'm glad my life's not boring. And that's exactly what happened. God did some miracles. He showed himself to be true. And that stretch of the road that I was telling him about is now just a really wonderful story that I love to tell people, because it is one of those wonderful journeys of faith where I experience the presence and the power of God. Jim Elliot said this, he is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain that which he cannot lose. So in Scripture, when it talks about sufferings, it says your light and momentary troubles are achieving to you an eternal glory that outweighs them all. So I got to take our sufferings and go like this. So some of you know this, but my wife's been sick for 16 months, and she still is right now. So people who know about it keep coming up and asking, how's she doing? And they wait for the, she's better answer. And I can't give it to them. She's not better. But I have to pull this back and go, somehow we don't see the rest of it. In the light of eternity, those sufferings are light and momentary, and they're achieving for us a glory that outweighs them all. I don't know how the next chapter goes, but I know how the book ends. And so I have to read this chapter in the light of eternity. And actually, that ties into the last one, your frailty in the light of eternity. This is... Hebrews 4 talks about entering into a rest. And he says we need to rest from our own work. Part of it is I have to realize that I'm frail because I'm not at my destination yet. And that reminds me that I'm not. And also that I need to, along the way, rest from my work, because it really is his work and he's going to complete it. We have to enter into his rest. And that's part of our discipline of Sabbath and our discipline of stopping. So in some ways, stopping and not working is in the light of eternity, right? Because I know that God rests. I know that God is going to get his work done with or without me, and that allows me to also step back and enter into the rest with that view of eternity and accept my frailty and accept my limitations. Your hope of eternal rest, your need for present rest, and even your willingness to retire or be replaced needs to be done in the context of eternity. Okay, what would happen if whatever information that you're facing right now in your leadership, you just did this to it? You put it in context. Because information only has meaning in context, and you said, whatever this is, I need to place it in the context of eternity and then look again at that in that context. How would that change that? I think in lots of different ways, because eternity is the context that God has for us as his children.